Welcome to a special gala Olympics version of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm the Anglo-Saxon Ken Reardon.
Ken, that's not true, but let's just...
That's right. I never thought of it that way. Well, anyway...
Don't worry, plenty of others have. So let's go right ahead and talk about some of the exciting news about the Olympics. The major figure, the person who's really captured everyone's imagination, is not a swimmer, not a basketball player, but a politician who's gone over there to, as best I can tell, introduce American Republican Party politics to the LIBOR Party.
That's a good joke. Well, actually, we're talking about Mitt Romney, who is doing his European tour this week. There'll be a lot of comparisons to the 250,000 people who came to see Barack Obama in Berlin in 2008. There are over 95 people, I understand, who've seen Mitt Romney so far in London.
Okay, well, let me make first clear what I meant by the LIBOR Party. I'm, of course, not referring to the Labour Party.
Oh, it's not a typo.
Of England, no. I'm referring to the people who got together to help raise money for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign in England, who are associated with some banks in that country, including Barclays Bank, which figures prominently in the recent financial revelations about manipulation of a certain interest rate called the LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, a very important interest rate. I know it's important to you with all your many loans.
Right.
So let's just say he was there to raise money, and some of the people from whom he was hoping to raise money have associations which could be problematic in terms of, well, negative advertising by the Obama campaign.
Well, it seems like it hasn't gone right from the moment he's gotten there. He's only been there, as of this podcast, a day or two. An unnamed aide used the word Anglo-Saxon to describe the strong relationship between the United States and Great Britain.
Well, all right. It isn't a relationship between Anglos and Saxons. What we're talking about is a heritage. And you can sort of get the idea of what that might have meant in a very benign sort of way.
Not if we have an African-American president.
But if we have an African-American president, and we have already been using the word foreign rather often with respect to some of his ideas.
And he's not American.
Playing to this underlying suspicion on the part of some people in the United States that Barack Obama is less American than they are. Well, that would seem to be going there.
Look, despite his best intentions, Mitt Romney seems to get caught up in this controversy that now he or some of his campaign staff now has to explain. The point is, this is a good time for Mitt Romney to make this trip, which is starts off at Great Britain, then goes to Israel, then goes to Poland. And of course, while this is going on, the Olympics is going on, which basically takes away the opportunity to even discuss a vice presidential nomination.
So That's right.
He's not going to replicate what Barack Obama accomplished when he went to Europe in 2008.
You mean that victory tour that he took months before he was elected?
250,000 people in Berlin, all those things. Clearly, this election is not going to be decided by foreign policy. Let's be honest here, Barack Obama, in many instances, on the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden, Gaddafi, the pulling out from the Iraqi and Afghan wars, the president seems to be doing well, at least getting good numbers on foreign policy. Of course, there's still things like Iran, which is upsetting Israel, and Syria, which is upsetting the world, and China and Korea. But anyway, foreign policy is something that Romney has to bone up on.
That's right. And it is the one area where the president's numbers are clearly most superior to his. But it's something that he is not shrinking from, as we saw when he appeared before the Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Reno, Nevada this week. Here's a little bit of what he said to them.
Has our ability to shape world events been enhanced or diminished? Have we gained greater confidence among our allies and greater respect from our adversaries? And perhaps most importantly, has the most severe security threat facing America and our friends, a nuclear-armed Iran, become more likely or less likely?
Clearly, Mitt Romney is hearing from a lot of his Republican critics that even if Obama has a better lead, he's got to take it to the president. He can't sit back and say, look, you have better numbers, I'll give you that. He can't give him anything. And while Romney has not come up with specifics, what he would do differently for the most part, maybe there was something on maybe a missile treaty with Russia, but I don't hear any differences with Obama, just that what's going on is not working well and he's going to be different.
It's not clear. It's not clear that there is a big hue and cry in the country for a different national security policy, with the possible exception, as you said, of Iran and Israel. And that's why he's going to Israel, to show he's got a better relationship with Bibi Netanyahu and with the regime currently running that country.
Right. Now, of course, the problem I think that many of Obama's critics are missing is that it's not so much that Obama is weak on Israel or soft on Israel, but he does have a very contentious relationship with Netanyahu, as you said. And I think that's part of the conflict that Romney would love to take advantage of. So if nothing else, domestically, it's an appeal for the Jewish vote, which the Republican Party is not known for, but they could make a difference in 2012.
Well, and as we have also talked about, Sheldon Adelson is a Republican Jewish contributor who gave a lot of money to Newt Gingrich and now has said he will give even more money to Mitt Romney and is raising money
He'll spend $100 million to defeat Barack Obama.
That's what he has said. And whether he's doing it for Mitt or whether he's doing it for somebody else or he's doing it for Sheldon Adelson, he wants to defeat Obama. Right. And much of that is driven by his feelings for Israel.
And he'll be on the trip.
And he will be on the trip, and he will be spending a great deal of money, and not just trying to influence the Jewish vote, I don't think, but also to try to galvanize a lot of the fundamentalist and evangelical vote in the United States that is fanatically pro-Israel and might not be all that excited about Mitt Romney, partly because of his own religious affiliation. And this is a way to get those people to feel more enthusiastic about turning out in November.
One place I noticed that Mitt Romney's not going to is Switzerland. And I'm surprised he's not, because he keeps coming up with these ads talking about these hands.
If you've been successful, you didn't get there on your own. Just if you got a business, that you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
My father's hands didn't build this company. My hands didn't build this company. Through hard work and a little bit of luck, we built this business. Why are you demonizing us for it?
Actually, it's not a person.
Oh.
It's a concept. It's the concept that an individual builds his own or her own fortune from nothing. It's the entrepreneurial notion.
And why is President Obama against that?
Well, you know, there's some chance, just a chance, that he is not entirely against people building their own business. Oh. I believe that the context of that particular remark was his talking, the president's talking, as he often does, about the role that government plays in making the entire economy work, building roads and bridges and things of that nature. And, you know, to a larger degree, the degree to which people working with other people build a business. So, yes, as an individual entrepreneur, you start an idea, you start a business, you build it up, and that's all fine, but you also can't take full credit for that because there are all these other people who made a contribution, whether they're your workers or people who lent you money or the government providing certain kinds of services, not to leave out the national security service that government provides by making it safe for you to be in your own business.
And that's exactly the Romney slash Republican argument that President Obama is talking about, is not so much small business ingenuity, but it's the role of government.
Those ads, taking my words about small business out of context, they're flat out wrong. Of course Americans build their own businesses. Every day, hardworking people sacrifice to meet a payroll, create jobs, and make our economy run. And what I said was that we need to stand behind them, as America always has, by investing in education and training, roads and bridges, research and technology. I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message because I believe we're all in this together.
It's not exactly clear how long this particular back and forth is going to go on.
It's going on much longer than it should have.
Probably so. But both campaigns have been guilty of taking little fragments of what one candidate or another has said, the gaffe. Mitt Romney saying, I like being able to fire people, or I enjoy firing people.
Or corporations.
When, of course, he was talking about people who had done a bad job in some sort of a contract situation. And taking that out of context and making it look as though Mitt Romney is some sort of monster. So both campaigns have been doing this, and then they come back with the, you know, the explanation ad and so on, and on we go. I wonder if when we get into the fall, if we get past the Olympics, then we get past the conventions,
the VP choice, and all the debates.
And then with the debates in October, and there will be three between these two campaigns all in October, will we then start talking a little bit less about gaps and things of that nature and talk more about the major issues before the country, if we can agree on what those are?
I don't recall such pettiness. And I mean, we've seen pettiness in presidential campaigns for the longest time. I still roll my eyes thinking of 1988 with somehow the issue was about the Pledge of Allegiance and the ACLU between Bush and Dukakis, the first Bush and the last Dukakis. But I still think this pettiness is going to go on. The fact that I'm still sitting in my living room watching attack ads in June and July, it's just, I don't remember ever that pettiness and nastiness starting so early.
Let me advance a theory here. Perhaps they're going at all these sort of small bore things and mistakes made by the other side because it's just too politically problematic to talk about taxes, to talk about the actual pain that has to be suffered by the country to get us out of the deficit, or to talk about other issues that people are out in the country really worrying about.
Well, a perfect example of that is what we saw in Aurora, Colorado about a week ago, that horrific mass shooting inside of a movie theater, and the issue of gun control, once again, every time there's whether it's Columbine or Virginia Tech, we always start to bring up, well, maybe there should be more laws, stronger laws. The issue comes up for 5 minutes, and then everybody rolls their eyes and say, nothing is going to change, and nothing changes.
And the advocates on both sides bring out all the arguments we've heard before. The people, say Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, come out and say, we've got to begin to move beyond this sort of Wild West culture, and people have to get beyond this idea that everybody needs to have armaments. And he makes a lot of rational arguments for gun control, and so do other gun control advocates. And then on the other side, the NRA and all the Second Amendment people say, well, wait a minute, this is a settled issue. We've already decided that in America we have freedom to own armaments, even up to, you know, assault weapons and so forth, because of our Constitution, and that sets us apart from the rest of the world. And the rest of the country that isn't particularly one advocate or the other advocate kind of heaves a big sigh of relief and goes, well, there's that argument again, and then it just sort of all goes away.
It was something very interesting to watch President Obama cite the Second Amendment following the tragedy in Aurora.
Immediately.
And I know that a lot of Democrats are, I hate to use the word gun-shy, but after what happened with the Clinton assault weapons ban in 1993, and many people think that a lot of Democrats who lost in 1994 was because of the vote on the assault weapons ban, which, of course, is no longer in effect.
It was expired, and Congress didn't renew it after it expired.
But here's the thing, though. The president spoke this week at the National Urban League, I believe, and he talked about the fact that we can have people with mental illness. We need stronger background checks. Well, the guy who committed this terrible crime in Aurora, he had no criminal past. He had no mental illness that we know
of. That we knew of at that time. Wouldn't have shown up in any background check. And he bought a lot of this stuff online.
And that kind of makes the point about, well, why do you need to buy 10,000 rounds of ammunition? Why do you need to buy a gun that could fire off 100 shots in 10 seconds or whatever? And yet that is all legal. So anyway, the Democrats, once again, they're not going to push for any changes in Congress. I believe Frank Lautenberg, the senator from New Jersey, started talking about assault weapons ban. But Harry Reid, a pro-gun Democratic majority leader from Nevada, is not going to bring that up in Congress.
And even if they were to bring it up, they wouldn't have 60 votes to bring it to the floor for a vote, and the House wouldn't even begin to consider it.
I don't think you'd even have a majority.
It would be a total waste of time. Now, if you're a gun control advocate, you will say, fine, let's waste our time on that instead of the things they are wasting their time on. Let's at least put the issue before the public. And yet the politicians in this particular instance see no benefit in November by doing so.
Well, another perfect example of working on an issue that is not going to go anywhere is what happened in the Senate this week with tax cuts.
And fairly high drama, too, because Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, did not insist on the 60-vote threshold, did not say, we're going to filibuster this, you come up with 60 votes to shut us up. He said, let's just have a straight up or down vote on our Republican plan for extending tax cuts from the Bush era and your Democratic plan.
And the Democratic plan, they would limit it to people earning $250,000 or less.
That's right. And so the Democrats wanted to raise taxes on the rich, in essence, and the Republicans didn't, although the Republican version, written by Orrin Hatch of Utah, who's running for re-election this year, also would have allowed to expire a lot of tax cuts from the Obama era. Most of the tax cut value in all of this discussion is from the Bush era. But there were some tax cuts in the stimulus plan back in 2009, and Hatch's plan would have knocked those out. So it would have preserved the tax cuts for people in the upper income brackets and lost some of the ones like the earned income tax credit, for example, for people at the lowest end of the scale. So that's not going to fly. The Democrats are not going to vote for that, and the Republicans are not going to vote for anything that raises taxes on people over 250.
So we had the two votes. The Hatch bill failed, as most people expected it to. The Democratic bill passed in the Senate with absolutely no hope for passage in the House. So both sides knew that neither was going to go anywhere, and yet the charade continues.
Well, it's a charade, and it's also a set of press releases for November. Everybody wants to be on record voting for or against one in particular view or another. And, of course, that's a formula for Congress achieving absolutely nothing.
Ron, next Tuesday is another example of the Tea Party versus the Republican establishment conflict. We can see that in Texas runoff of the Senate. It's a seat that Kay Bailey Hutchison is giving up. Ted Cruz, the former state solicitor general of Texas, a Tea Party favorite, is taking on David Dewhurst. Now, very conservative guy. He's been, I think, lieutenant governor like 10 years or something.
And that's a very important job in Texas.
It's actually more powerful than the governor of Texas. And speaking of which, the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, has already endorsed Dewhurst. And yet, the Tea Party folks say that Dewhurst has been around too long. He's a career politician. He's too willing to compromise with the Democrats. Ted Cruz is the real thing, another Marco Rubio versus Charlie Crist. And Tuesday, July 31st, big runoff there.
That's a fascinating race because here we have, again, the Tea Party getting behind the Hispanic candidate against a, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant kind of perfect example of the Republican establishment. On the other hand, the Tea Party aligning itself with kind of the new face of the Republican Party in each state. Two of the three largest states in the union in population. Sorry, Ken, but I'm afraid New York is sliding into number four.
Ron, I left New York in 1968.
No, you never did.
I never left New York.
No, if you are still a Yankee fan, you have never left New York.
Oh, then I'll never leave New York.
Well, there you have it.
Okay, I'm sorry.
All right. So the Tea Party, yes, and the Tea Party is trying to identify itself with the newness in those two states, and the newness is, interestingly enough, represented by Hispanics in both cases, who I think both trace their roots to Cuba.
That's correct. I think Ted Cruz's father was born in Cuba with an R. That's my New
You'll
York.
Never leave
I'll never
New
leave
York.
New York. Exactly right. But also the generational battle between young and old in Republican primaries and the Tea Party's involvement. We've seen it in Indiana with Richard Murdoch versus, you know, the long-serving Dick Lugar. We saw it in Utah.
Who just celebrated his 13,000th vote in the Senate this week.
Right.
13,000.
That's a busy week. God. Anyway,
and even for Dick Lugar.
Exactly. And we also saw that in Utah as well. Dan Lilienquist, while he lost to Orrin Hatch, obviously the Tea Party challenge made Orrin Hatch perhaps even a more true conservative because his voting record has been much more to the right since that challenge. So it just seems to be generational. But again, it's one thing to pick on Dick Lugar, who's, you know, very friendly with Barack Obama and votes for the Democrats a lot. David Dewhurst is a solid conservative. He may not be the most exciting guy in the world, but he's certainly not a rhino.
No, but he's not new.
No,
and I think
new,
the
right?
Tea Party
yeah.
wants new. And it wants people that they bring up out of kind of nowhere in some cases. Former solicitors general are nowhere near as important as the lieutenant governor
That
of
was
Texas.
The perfect example of what we saw 2 years ago in Florida with Charlie Crist and that upstart Marco Rubio.
That's right. And could you say the name of the guy who ran against Orrin Hatch one more time?
Dave Lilienquist.
I just love to hear you pronounce Swedish names. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, and speaking of friendly, we saw this week the odd spectacle of a clearly conservative Republican member of Congress from Alaska embracing, in fact, kind of literally. A liberal Democratic woman from Hawaii in her campaign ads for the Senate.
When vital Native Hawaiian and Native Alaskan education programs were at risk in Congress.
Maisie and I got together and put our partisan differences aside and solved this problem for our people at home.
And once Don and I joined together as Republican and Democrat, I had to battle my own party leadership to get our amendment passed.
It's true. I watched Maisie do it. And let me tell you, that Nancy Pelosi is one stubborn...
Don, what have I told you?
I will not say anything else. But here's what's important, Hawaii. If you're looking for a United States senator who doesn't just talk about bipartisanship, but actually knows how to work with both Republicans and Democrats to get things done, Maisie Hirono will be that senator.
What's going on here? can.
Well, this is very odd, and you have to watch the commercial to see how odd it is, because here it is, Don Young, the Republican from Alaska, first elected in 1973, and here he is, literally, as you say, embracing Mazie Hirono, a Democrat from Hawaii, involved in a big Senate race there. But what's interesting, Don Young keeps talking about how much he despises Nancy Pelosi, and yet Mazie Hirono says...
Not now, Don. No, don't talk about that now.
Exactly. I will approve this message, but not if you keep criticizing Nancy Pelosi.
It's funny. It's a funny ad. I mean, it sounds awkward, but even the awkwardness of it is kind of humorous, and this kind of I'm crazy for Mazie thing... I mean, I assume that the whole point of this and the reason she wanted to do this in her campaign is because she's trying to bring over the independent vote in Hawaii that's attracted to the Republican candidate, former Governor Linda Lingle.
But several things here that surprise me. First of all, she still has to get past Ed Case, the former congressman, in a primary. Why are you looking for Republican endorsements when you have to win Democratic votes in the primary?
Because she wants to convince Democratic voters in Hawaii she's got the better chance to beat Lingle.
Perhaps. But here's another thing. Apparently, there is some kind of Alaska-Hawaii linkage. Of course, it's 49 and 50, but there is some link there. Remember when Ted Stevens was in big ethics problems.
Dan Inouye
was one of the few Democratic senators who came out saying, look, Ted Stevens is a good guy in my book.
And people attributed that at the time to their both being World War II veterans.
Perhaps that's true.
But there is some of that. But I think you're right. There is a 49th, 50th state alliance on special issues, particularly of interest to those two states. And they refer to one in the ad, which is Native American funding for programs. But before we leave this week, Ken, I think we really ought to address what I believe is the listener's biggest question of the podcast this week. Who's ahead in Iowa for 2016?
Well, apparently there's a plosive polling company called Public Policy Polling.
With an explosive poll.
Apparently, yes. That has Hillary Clinton with a huge lead over Joe Biden.
Huge lead.
And Andrew Cuomo for 2016 in Iowa.
Wow.
Because,
I mean,
We don't have enough to talk about in 2012 that we really need to know who's ahead in 2016.
We're bored with these candidates. We're tired of this year. We don't want this entire situation we're in. We want to imagine what the country will be like in 2016. Much better, one hopes. And we want to imagine that we have a wide open contest for the Democratic nomination in Iowa. But just in case, there is also a wide open contest for the Republican nomination in Iowa, should Barack Obama win a second term, the PPP also polled on Republican candidates. And they found that Mike Huckabee is still very popular in the state of Iowa, where, of course, he won the caucus in 2008. And number two in that poll was Rick Santorum, who barely won the caucus in 2012. So Huckabee, Santorum, duking it out in Iowa, alongside perhaps Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden and Andrew Cuomo.
I suddenly cannot wait until 2016.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
Ron, before we go, before the podcast is over, you know we usually end the podcast by talking about somebody who's left us. I think Sean Walbeck of Bellingham, Washington, has left us, or at least he's left his senses, because according to the Bellingham Herald, you read that, don't you?
The Bellingham, yes. Washington Herald?
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's a lovely town.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lovely town, Western Washington.
Yeah. That's
college town.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Very nice.
Right. Well, anyway, Sean Walbeck, who is performing in the local version of On Golden Pond, was interviewed by the Bellingham Herald, and they ask him, where did you grow up, or what are some of your interests? And there's also a question, are you a political junkie? NPR says you are. And then Sean Walbeck says NPR should know because I'm a super goober fan of Ken Rudin's online political junkie column.
Super goober.
The Weekly. I think he spelled it W-E-A-K, but The Weekly.
That's spelling it correctly.
Pun-soaked podcast. He shares with Ron Elving. He's won a scuttle button. He's once designated as the listener on the podcast. The question is, what is wrong with Sean Walbeck?
I think we'll have to leave that hanging and perhaps solicit an answer from the other listener.
Hmm.
And that's really it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm the super goober Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
London calling to the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls.